Looking at it from their point of view, the Times is the perfect host body for the virus. Schweitzer had begun his career as a researcher at the conservative Hoover Institution, digging through Soviet archives to learn how the Russians viewed Ronald Reagan during the Cold War. In 2004, he co-authored a well-regarded history of the Bush family, The Bush's Portrait of a Dynasty, that drew on interviews with many of its members, including Jeb Bush. But Schweitzer grew disillusioned with Washington and became radicalized against what he perceived to be a bipartisan culture of corruption. "To me, Washington, D.C. is a little bit like professional wrestling," he said. "When I was growing up in Seattle, I'd turn on Channel 13, the public access station, and watch wrestling. At first I thought, man, these guys hate each other because they're beating the crap out of each other. But I eventually realized they're actually business partners. Half the people watching know that, the other people don't know that. But what matters is that they create the spectacle. There's a lot in D.C. that's like professional wrestling. It's done for show, but ultimately, there's a business partnership between the combatants." Schweitzer, 50, is friendly, sandy-haired, and a little pudgy, a neighborly sort you'd meet at a barbecue and take an instant liking to. Bannon nurtured this regular Joe appeal by forbidding him from wearing a necktie when he's on television. Bannon and Schweitzer followed two principles when conceiving Clinton Cash. First, it would avoid nutty conspiracy theories. "We have a mantra," said Bannon. "Facts get shares. Opinions get shrugs." Second, they would heed the lesson Bannon learned at Goldman. Specialize. Hillary Clinton's story, they decided, was too sprawling and familiar to tackle in its entirety. So they focused only on the past decade, her least familiar period, and especially on the hundreds of millions of dollars flowing into the Clinton Foundation. Bannon called this approach periodicity. As with so many of the Clintons' troubles, the couple's own behavior provided copious material for GAI's investigators. When Clinton became Secretary of State, the Foundation signed an agreement with the Obama White House to disclose all of its contributors. It didn't follow through. So GAI researchers combed tax filings, flight logs, and foreign government documents to turn up what the Clinton Foundation had withheld. Their most effective method was mining the so-called deep web, the 97% or so of information on the Internet that isn't indexed for search engines such as Google, and therefore is difficult to find. "Welcome to the Matrix," said Tony, GAI's head data scientist, as he mapped out the deep web on a whiteboard for a visitor. We agreed I wouldn't publish his last name. A presentation on the hidden recesses of the web followed. The deep web, he explained, consists of a lot of useless or depreciated information, stuff in foreign languages and so on. But a whole bunch of it is very useful, if you can find it. Tony specialized in finding the good stuff, which he did by writing software protocols that spider through the deep web. Because this requires heavy computing power, GAI struck a deal to use the services of a large European provider during off-peak hours. "We've got $1.3 billion of equipment. I'm using it almost full capacity," he said. This effort yielded a slew of unreported foundation donors who appear to have benefited financially from their relationship with the Clintons, including the uranium mining executives cited by the New York Times, who showed up on an unindexed Canadian government website. These donations illustrated a pattern of commingling private money and government policy that disturbed even many Democrats. Clinton Cash caused a stir not only because of these revelations, but also because of how they arrived. GAI is set up more like a Hollywood movie studio than a think tank. The creative mind through which all its research flows and is disseminated belongs to a beaming young Floridian named Wynton Hall, a celebrity ghostwriter who's penned 18 books, six of them New York Times bestsellers, including Trump's 2011 book, Time to Get Tough, Making America Number One Again. Hall's job is to transform dry think tank research into vivid, viral-ready political dramas that can be unleashed on a set schedule, like summer blockbusters. We work very long and hard to build a narrative, storyboarding it out months in advance, Hall said. We're not going public until we have something so tantalizing that any editor at a serious publication would be an idiot to pass it up and give a competitor the scoop. To this end, Hull peppered his colleagues with slogans so familiar around the office that they became known by their acronyms. ABBN, Always Be Breaking News, was one. Another slogan was, Depth Beats Speed. Time-strapped reporters squeezed for copy would gratefully accept original, fact-based research, because most of what they're inundated with from PR flacks is garbage. The modern economics of the newsroom don't support big investigative reporting staffs, said Bannon. You wouldn't get a Watergate, a Pentagon Papers today, because nobody can afford to let a reporter spend 7 months on a story. We can. We're working as a support function. GAI does this because Bannon decided it's the secret to how conservatives can hack the mainstream media. Hall has distilled this, too, into a slogan. Anchor left, pivot right. It means that weaponizing a story onto the front page of the New York Times, the left, is infinitely more valuable than publishing it on Breitbart, the right, because the Times reaches millions of readers inclined to vote Democratic. This approach prompted a wholesale change in how Bannon and his Confederates think about elite media. We don't look at the mainstream media as enemies, because we don't want our work to be trapped in the conservative ecosystem, said Hall. We live and die by the media. Every time we're launching a book, I'll build a battle map that literally breaks down by category every headline we're going to place, every op-ed Peter's going to publish. Getting our message embedded in mainstream outlets is what gets us the biggest blast radius. Once that work has permeated the mainstream, once it's found a host body, in David Brock's phrase, then comes the pivot. Heroes and villains emerge and become grist for a juicy, Breitbart News narrative. The story takes on a life of its own. Hillary Clinton became the biggest narrative of all, even though none of the GAI reporting went directly to Breitbart. It didn't have to. With Clinton cash, we never really broke a story, said Bannon. But you go to Breitbart, and we've got 20 things. We're linking to everybody else's stuff. We're aggregating. We'll pull stuff from the left. It's a rolling phenomenon. Huge traffic. Everybody's invested. As devious as this plot was, it could never have succeeded to the degree that it did had Clinton not abetted it with such vigor. That summer, she failed to emerge as the overwhelming frontrunner everyone had expected, weighed down by stories on Clinton Foundation buckraking and the revelation that she had kept a private email server as Secretary of State and destroyed much of her correspondence. She also refused to release transcripts of highly paid speeches she delivered to Goldman Sachs and other Wall Street firms. In August, emails surfaced showing that Bill Clinton, through the foundation, had sought State Department permission to accept speaking fees in repressive countries such as North Korea and the Republic of the Congo. A poll the same day found that the word voters associated most with his wife was liar. Clinton's tone-deaf response to the steady drip of revelations only deepened their impact, because it conveyed a sense of entitlement that was off-putting even to many Democrats. Confronted over her failure to disclose foreign donors, Clinton and her aides stonewalled, or scolded reporters for not focusing instead on the foundation's good works, or claimed it didn't matter. When the Boston Globe discovered that a local branch of the Clinton Foundation had uniformly bypassed Clinton's agreement with the White House to disclose foreign donors, a spokeswoman told the paper that they deemed it unnecessary to reveal those names, and refused. Rehearsed in the rigors of right-wing attacks, Clinton's aides went after the source of so many of them, Peter Schweitzer's book. They tried to discredit Clinton Cash, as they had successfully done to numerous anti-Clinton polemics in the 1990s. But their efforts mostly failed, because Schweitzer's book was not filled with outlandish rumors and blind quotes, as the earlier books had been. It contained documentable facts that reporters could check out for themselves. To Bannon's delight, many did, and decided to pursue them further. We've got the 15 best investigative reporters at the 15 best newspapers in the country, all chasing after Hillary Clinton, he exulted that summer. To the staff of GAI, Clinton looked like someone trapped in quicksand, whose flailing only worsened her plight. Here we are, sitting here in flip-flops in Tallahassee, said Hall, and this massive Clinton operation is coming at our little tiny nonprofit like we're some huge entity. He laughed. We're up on the balcony smoking cigars and writing press releases, and their heads are exploding. It's kind of surreal. Even amid Clinton's struggles, however, Democrats were confident she would ultimately prevail. Some were even willing to concede that Bannon and his ilk were more effective than the conservatives who targeted Bill Clinton 25 years earlier. They've adapted into a higher species, said Chris Lehane, a Clinton White House staffer and hardened veteran of the partisan wars of the 90s. But these guys always blow themselves up in the end. Bannon disagreed, and as always, had a historical analogy to explain why. What he was really pursuing was something like the old Marxist dialectical concept of heightening the contradictions. Only rather than foment revolution among the proletariat, he was trying to disillusion Clinton's natural base of support. Bernie Sanders's unexpected strength suggested to him that it was working. He was sure that Sanders's rise was destined to end in crashing disappointment. Having thrilled to his populist purity, his supporters would never reconcile themselves to Clinton, because the donors featured in Clinton Cash violated just about every ideal liberals hold dear. You look at what they've done in the Colombian rainforest. Look at the arms merchants, the warlords, the human trafficking. If you take anything that the left professes to be a cornerstone value, the Clintons have basically played them for fools, Bannon said. They've enriched themselves while playing up the worst cast of characters in the world. Bill Clinton is not going around the world with Bill Gates or the head of GE. By and large, it's guys who need something and can't get access to the inner sanctums of world power on their own. It's third-world reputation laundering. In the meantime, a new narrative was emerging. Bannon could see it in the Breitbart traffic numbers. Donald Trump had a bigger megaphone than anyone in politics, even Clinton, and he was showing an unparalleled ability to dictate media coverage that Bannon could only marvel at. What he wanted the media to cover, constantly and at length, was only one thing: Donald Trump. 8. The traffic is absolutely filthy. Trump is a beast, Bannon was cackling, practically giddy over what he had just witnessed. He still couldn't believe it. It was June 16, 2015. Trump had just glided down the Trump Tower escalator with Melania in tow, announced his entry into the presidential race, and then proceeded to unload a mind-bending, mostly improvised, 45-minute rant, during which he casually referred to Mexican immigrants as rapists and criminals. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best, Trump said, standing at a lectern and pointing to members of the audience. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. To Republican Party leaders, Trump's performance was a horror show, the very antithesis of the message they yearned to project of a more welcoming, inclusive GOP than the one Mitt Romney had led to defeat in 2012. After that loss, RNC Chairman Reince Priebus had commissioned a rigorous postmortem of all that had gone wrong and what the party could do to fix it. The report, which became known as the Republican Autopsy, concluded that the GOP was committing demographic suicide by insulting and antagonizing the fast-growing population of Hispanic voters, who didn't take kindly to Romney's suggestion that illegal immigrants would resort to self-deportation if only their lives were made unpleasant enough. The autopsy's urgent recommendation was to reverse this approach, and fast. If Hispanic Americans perceive that a GOP nominee or candidate does not want them in the United States, i.e., self-deportation, they will not pay attention to our next sentence. It continued, "We must embrace and champion comprehensive immigration reform. If we do not, our party's appeal will continue to shrink to its core constituencies only." News of Trump's announcement speech instantly went viral, rocketing across cable television and Twitter. But while party leaders winced, Trump's small coterie of advisors, with the exception of his daughter Ivanka, wasn't panicking over the rapists charge, as any normal campaign would have, but was in fact relieved and excited that his presidential announcement had broken through. A few days earlier, Trump and some aides had offered the exclusive story of his upcoming entrance into the race to Maggie Haberman, a star reporter at the New York Times, and had been rebuffed. Trump's long history of self-promotional flirtations with running had left most insiders skeptical that he would ever follow through. Fearing that Trump might be ignored, his aides had pushed back his announcement date. "We were originally trying to do it on June 14th, which happens to be Flag Day and Mr. Trump's birthday," said Corey Lewandowski, his first campaign manager. "But it fell on a Sunday, and we knew that we wanted to announce on a Tuesday or a Wednesday to get as much attention as we could, ideally enough to carry through into the Sunday shows." Trump's attacks on Mexican immigrants and his vow to build a great wall at the U.S.-Mexico border ensured that a lack of attention was one problem Trump would not have to confront. Not then, not ever. Leaving nothing to chance, he invited Breitbart News' Matthew Boyle up to his 26th-floor office immediately following his announcement for an exclusive interview and some extra anti-immigrant, anti-establishment jawboning, just to ensure that the Republican base heard his message loud and clear. They heard it, and they loved it. Bannon, who was ecstatic that Trump had not softened his message now that he was truly in the race, splashed the news across Breitbart. Then he got busy arranging a surreal visit Trump would make to the U.S.-Mexico border a few weeks hence, one that would further affix his anti-immigrant identity at the center of his presidential campaign. Although it wasn't included in the soundbites broadcast on the evening news, Trump, just after he delivered his notorious rapists line, had given a citation for the charge. "I speak to border guards," he said, "and they tell us what we're getting." Trump really did do this, and it was an early example of the Trump-Bannon-Breitbart nexus that operated continually throughout the campaign, in varying degrees of public acknowledgement. While Trump was unquestionably his own chief strategist, and often a shrewd one, he had a constant thirst for input, whether it came in the form of cable news punditry, phone calls with friends, or visits with politically sympathetic groups, like the border guards. One reason Bannon decided to establish a Texas bureau was to help Breitbart develop sources among the Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents and Border Patrol officers stationed at the U.S.-Mexico border. Many of them held fiercely restrictionist views on immigration that mirrored those of Breitbart's editors, and left the agents increasingly at odds with the pro-reform sentiment building among the leaders in both parties. By letting it be known that Breitbart was, as Bannon put it, a safe pair of hands, the site became the go-to destination for border agents seeking a sympathetic media outlet in which to express their views or vent about immigration matters that they believed the mainstream media was purposely suppressing. This is how Breitbart became one of the first outlets to publicize the child migrant crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border in the summer of 2014. Border agents took snapshots of overcrowded detention facilities and provided them to Breitbart, whose alarmist stories, border open for criminals as agents forced to babysit illegals, were amplified by the Drudge Report and spread to dozens of mainstream outlets. In the weeks following Trump's announcement, Bannon arranged to have local 2455, the Border Patrol Union in Laredo, Texas, invite Trump to the border for a visit on July 23rd. The union's Laredo spokesman was a regular guest on Bannon's radio show. Under pressure from the National Union, Local 2455 was forced at the last minute to rescind the invitation. But Trump came anyway, trailing a massive press contingent, and was clearly welcomed by the local border agents. The National Border Patrol Council, which represents 16,500 of the roughly 21,000 agents who work for the agency, later endorsed Trump, the first time the union had taken sides in a presidential race. The National Immigration and Customs Enforcement Council, which represents 7,600 ICE agents and employees, also endorsed Trump. This, too, was its first presidential endorsement. From the moment the Trump-emblazoned Boeing 757-200 airliner touched down in Laredo, Trump's visit was sheer pandemonium. He had spent the days leading up to the trip bizarrely insisting that he was putting himself in grave danger, even though FBI statistics showed that Laredo was the 19th safest city in the country. Trump didn't exactly dress for combat. He arrived at the Laredo airport in a gold-buttoned navy blazer, khakis, and white golf shoes, with a matching white Make America Great Again cap, and was besieged by more than 100 reporters and dozens of camera crews. Still, he kept up the ruse. People are saying, "Oh, it's so dangerous what you're doing, Mr. Trump. It's so dangerous," a straight-faced Trump told the assembled press. "I have to do it. We're showing something." Reporters piled into two charter buses furnished by Trump and followed his police-escorted motorcade to the World Trade Bridge, where 18-wheelers were lined up waiting to cross the border. In a brief press conference, Trump, always the ringmaster, attacked the anti-immigration bona fides of Texas Governor Rick Perry, boasted about his own poll numbers, insisted that anti-Trump protesters along the highway were all in favor of Trump, and reiterated his vow to build a wall and stop the illegals. "I'll bring the jobs back," he declared. "And you know, the Hispanics are going to get those jobs, and they're going to love Trump." He corrected himself. "They already do." And with that, Trump zipped back to the airport and went home to New York, having spent all of 3 hours on the ground. The trip's purpose was pure theater. It was intended to show that Trump meant what he'd said and was willing to go to the border and say it there, too, without equivocation. It was also Trump's way of thumbing his nose at critics of his rapist's comment, such as Jeb Bush, who called it extraordinarily ugly, even as he denied Bush political oxygen by dominating presidential campaign coverage. In fact, Bush's support was already crumbling under the weight of Trump's steady, emasculating, low-energy assaults. 3 days before the Laredo visit, Trump had surged past Bush to take a commanding lead in the Washington Post ABC News poll of Republican voters. He would never relinquish it. It took a certain moxie to dream up stunts like the border visit. Trump loved moxie, and he liked the ideas he was getting from Bannon, especially the dropped jaw reaction they produced on cable news. Although Trump didn't dwell on policy details, Bannon pitched in there, too. Trump was coming under fire because his campaign hadn't produced a single policy paper. So Bannon arranged for Nunberg and Ann Coulter, the conservative pundit, to quickly produce a white paper on Trump's immigration policies. When the campaign released it, Coulter, without disclosing her role, tweeted that it was the greatest political document since the Magna Carta. Throughout the campaign, Long before Steve actually joined the campaign, he was active through Breitbart, but also by providing very important and unsolicited advice, said Lewandowski. He would call Mr. Trump or he would call me and say, hey, here's a recommendation. We talked to Steve a lot. I think for Mr. Trump, authenticity is the most important thing. Steve's authentic. His success financially gave him the freedom to not have to do things he doesn't want to do, not shave, not wear a tie. That's unheard of in the world of Trump. But he's achieved a remarkable amount of personal success, and that matters a lot to Trump. It helped, too, that Bannon's success included Hollywood and a background in entertainment. On The Apprentice, Trump rarely followed a script, instead taking a concept and improvising to fill the role. In politics, as in television, Trump could instantly spot a good idea, and then, through some combination of intuition and bravado, improvise with consistently successful results. As the world was learning, television and politics were not so different. By August, Trump sat comfortably atop every major Republican presidential poll. The Laredo trip, and more broadly, his refusal to apologize for any transgression, no matter how crass or offensive, lit up a segment of the Republican base that had been dormant or uncommitted. Trump's celebrity and name ID had always gotten him a respectable percentage in the polls, usually somewhere in the low teens. Now he shot up into the mid to high 20s, which in a crowded field of 17 candidates was enough to put him solidly in the lead. Even so, the party establishment took solace in the belief that Trump was heading for an inevitable fall. The first GOP debate, sponsored by Fox News, loomed on August 6th in Cleveland. Within Fox, Trump was fast emerging as a polarizing figure. He had long been a friend of the network and cherished his weekly Monday call-in segment on Fox and Friends. But his entrance into the race and surprising strength in the Republican field were causing tension. Fox anchors, like other media figures, initially treated his candidacy with arched eyebrow amusement. But as Trump pulled ahead of the field, that began to change. Murdoch and Ailes, both champions of immigration reform, had had a soft spot for Marco Rubio ever since the dynamic young Florida senator had pitched them on the merits of his Gang of Eight reform bill over a private dinner in 2013 in the executive dining room of News Corporation's Manhattan headquarters. In response, the network curbed its criticism of the reform plan. But others at Fox News, Sean Hannity foremost among them, were ardent Trump backers with a direct line to Bannon, whose influence some Fox hosts knew about and didn't like. "Bannon is human garbage," one of them fumed. Lurking beneath it all was a worry that Trump's antics might tarnish the Republican brand and thereby ease Hillary Clinton's path to the White House. Amid this uneasiness and suspicion, Megyn Kelly, who was set to co-moderate the Cleveland debate, was something of a wild card. A former defense attorney and political independent, Kelly was a rising star at Fox News, with pretensions to being a serious journalist. In May, Trump had appeared on her primetime show, The Kelly File, without incident. But a week before the debate, Trump's network grew alarmed at Kelly's eagerness to tout a story published in the Daily Beast, recounting accusations Trump's ex-wife Ivana made in a divorce deposition that he had raped her in 1989. Over two nights, Kelly did multiple segments on the story that included her sharp criticism of Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, who had wrongly claimed, "You cannot rape your spouse, and there's very clear case law," and then made vague but ominous threats to the Daily Beast reporter. Trump was scheduled to appear on The Kelly File 3 days before the debate, but lost his nerve and canceled at the last minute. Kelly had been hammering him all week, he complained to a friend, and he was certain she was out to get him. It turned out he was right. Trump's toughest opponents in Cleveland were not his fellow candidates, but the Fox News moderators who went right after him, none with more gusto than Kelly. As soon as the lights went up, she went straight for the jugular. "You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals," she admonished him. "Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president?" Trump saw the attack coming and cut her off. "Only Rosie O'Donnell," he barked. "No, it wasn't," Kelly replied. "Your Twitter account..." The audience interrupted with applause for Trump. "Thank you," he replied. For the record, it was well beyond Rosie O'Donnell. "Yes, I'm sure it was." "Your Twitter account has several disparaging comments about women's looks," Kelly continued. "You once told a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice it would be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president? And how will you answer the charge from Hillary Clinton, who is likely to be the Democratic nominee, that you are part of the war on women?" "The big problem this country has is being politically correct," Trump practically shouted, invoking conservatives' favorite term of disdain. "I've been challenged by so many people, and I don't frankly have time for total political correctness. And to be honest with you, this country doesn't have time either." The crowd roared again. Trump continued hurling insults, going after O'Donnell, political reporters, Bo Bergdahl, China, Mexico, Japan, moneylenders, and just about everyone in Washington. "Our leaders are stupid," he declared. "Our politicians are stupid." He soon worked around to his greatest applause line. "We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly," he said. "We need to keep illegals out." Although Kelly was correct in every citation, the audience in the hall was plainly with Trump, cheering and oh-ing at each thrilling provocation as if they were ringside at a prize fight. The evening proved to be pivotal for Trump. Going in, he'd never had to debate his opponents, nor submit to steady, hostile questioning by seasoned journalists. Because Trump didn't even feign interest in the policy details that are the ammunition of most candidate debates, the broad expectation was that he was walking into a turkey shoot. Yet not only was Trump unrattled, but his bravado and aggression set the tone for the debate. Every candidate strained to match his energy. Emulating Trump's swagger, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie tore into Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. But no one except Paul mustered the courage to directly attack Trump. And Paul may have regretted it, as Trump dispatched him with a devastating put-down. "You're having a hard time tonight," that was deadly because it was true. Consciously or otherwise, several candidates echoed Trump's points, and some even genuflected before the unlikely front-runner. "Donald Trump is hitting a nerve in this country," Ohio Governor John Kasich said at one point. "Mr. Trump is touching a nerve because people want to see a wall being built." Going into the debate, the big battle was supposed to be between Trump and Jeb Bush. But Trump sensed that his real opponent was Fox News. And throughout the evening, he and his inquisitors battled back and forth like gladiators. Kelly did manage to inflict some wounds. Rattling off the liberal positions Trump had once held, she stopped him cold by asking, "When did you actually become a Republican?" Trump's bluster momentarily escaped him. "I've evolved on many issues over the years, and you know who else has? Ronald Reagan," he answered feebly. "Very much evolved." But Trump wasn't finished, not even when the moderators were done. After the debate, he inaugurated what was soon to become a tradition of walking off the stage and directly to the television cameras to critique the event he'd just participated in. He didn't let up. The next evening, Trump lit into the Fox News moderators and complained about Kelly in particular. To CNN's Don Lemon, he said, "You could see there was blood coming out of her eyes. Blood coming out of her wherever." A media storm quickly ensued over whether Trump was suggesting that Kelly had gone after him unfairly because she was menstruating. But Trump's anger at Fox News and Kelly also set off another storm that didn't fully register until the next day. Yet it opened up an enduring divide in the Republican Party that would carry through the election. The divide was between mainstream Republicans and those primarily loyal to Trump, and centered on whether Fox was subjecting Trump to ordinary journalistic inquiry or attacking him with the intention of destroying him to make way for a more acceptable candidate. Among other things, this divide split Fox News and Breitbart. Within minutes of the debate's end, even as Trump was still nursing his grievances on live television, reporters began to realize that the revelations of his past behavior, so bluntly excavated by Kelly, had indeed caused an intense reaction among Republican voters, not against Trump, but against Fox News. One method reporters use to gauge voter sentiment is to arrange ahead of time to speak with supporters of a candidate as soon as a debate concludes. Among Trump supporters, the sense of betrayal was acute. "I had more emotion about Fox News tonight than I did about Donald Trump," said Janet Roberts, 69, a nurse in Belleville, Ohio, who was backing Trump. "Those questions were not professional questions. They were bullying. They were set up to purposely make them all look bad. Our country is a mess, and I feel like the debate was an example of that. I'm still with Trump." Bannon and the Breitbart editors had the same reaction and immediately turned on Megyn Kelly with a fusillade of negative articles. She became the newest Breitbart narrative, the backstabbing, self-promoting betrayer of the cause, and Breitbart became the locus of pro-Trump, anti-Fox conservative anger. Between Thursday night, when the debate took place, and Sunday evening, Breitbart published 25 stories on Kelly, and the site's editor-in-chief, Alex Marlowe, went on CNN to accuse Fox News of trying to take out Donald Trump and staging a gotcha debate. The intensity of Republican anger stunned Fox News executives. The debate had drawn a record 24 million viewers. Now many of them were apoplectic at the network's top talent. In the beginning, virtually 100% of the emails were against Megyn Kelly, a Fox source told New York's Gabriel Sherman. Roger was not happy. Most of the Fox viewers were taking Trump's side. Word spread through the building that Kelly was furious and had personally complained to Ailes. By Sunday, the attacks against her showed no sign of letting up, as other conservative opinion makers, such as radio host Mark Levin, agreed that her questions to Trump had been unfair. In a panic, Ailes called Bannon and begged him to call off the attacks. "Steve, this isn't fair and it's killing us," Ailes said. "You have to stop it." "Fuck that. That was outrageous what she did," Bannon retorted. "She pulled every trick out of the leftist playbook." "You've got to knock this crap off, Steve." "Not until she backs off Trump. She's still going after him on her show." "She's the star of this network. Cut it out." The call ended without resolution. Bannon and Ailes would not speak again for almost a year. Kelly indeed refused to back down and mocked Trump during a weekend Fox News appearance by posing a rhetorical question. "If you can't get past me, how are you going to handle Vladimir Putin?" On Monday's Kelly file, she addressed the controversy in a direct-to-camera statement. "Mr. Trump is an interesting man who has captured the attention of the electorate. That's why he's leading in the polls," she said. "Trump, who is the front-runner, will not apologize. And I certainly will not apologize for doing good journalism." But what irritated Bannon even more was the sudden outpouring of support Kelly was receiving from people whom he considered sworn enemies of the conservative cause. Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski of MSNBC's Morning Joe, the whole fucking cast of CNN, and, most gallingly, Hillary Clinton, who he felt never met a gender controversy she wouldn't exploit for political gain. The next day, in a fit of pique, Bannon and Marlowe composed a point-by-point indictment of Kelly's alleged transgressions and published it on Breitbart. "The Arrogance of Power, Megyn Kelly's Good Journalism." While it was an unvarnished depiction of Breitbart editorial sentiment, the piece served a double purpose. It kept the fight going. As Bannon confessed to an associate, "The web traffic is absolutely filthy." The blowback against Kelly and Fox News kept mounting. Trump was livid. Over the weekend, he had called Hannity and told him he was boycotting Fox. Fearful of the damage Trump could do to the Fox brand, Ailes relented and called him to apologize, a concession Trump tweeted out. Roger Ailes just called. He is a great guy and assures me that Trump will be treated fairly on at Fox News. His word is always good. Bannon, however, remained a problem. Breitbart wasn't relenting. In fact, its attacks on Kelly were growing more personal. Flashback. Megyn Kelly discusses her husband's penis and her breasts on Howard Stern, read a Breitbart headline on the one-week anniversary of the debate. Not knowing what else to do, Ailes dispatched his personal lawyer, Peter Johnson Jr., to the Breitbart embassy in Washington, D.C., to deliver a personal message to Bannon to end the war on Kelly. Bannon loathed Johnson, whom he referred to privately as that nebbishy goofball lawyer on Fox and Friends. Johnson had leveraged his proximity to Ailes to become a Fox News pundit. When he arrived at the embassy, Johnson got straight to the point. If Bannon didn't stop immediately, he would never again appear on Fox News. "You've got a very strong relationship with Roger," Johnson warned. "You've got to stop these attacks on Megyn. She's the star, and if you don't stop, there are going to be consequences." Bannon was incensed at the threat. "She's pure evil," he told Johnson, "and she will turn on him one day. We're going full bore. We're not going to stop. I'm going to unchain the dogs." The conversation was brief and unpleasant, and it ended with a cinematic flourish. "I want you to go back to New York and quote me to Roger," Bannon said. "Go fuck yourself." Even as it captivated the public's attention, Trump's presidential campaign often seemed to exist as a thing apart from the real world of politics that only perpetuated itself through a willful collective suspension of disbelief. For all Trump's success in the polls and debates, the prevailing assumption in Washington was that voters would come to their senses before the first ballots were cast, and this strange moment in American politics would pass. Perhaps because Trump's insurgency had all the elements of a gripping reality TV show, and he himself was sui generis, political analysts tended not to connect the Trump phenomenon to other developments occurring at the same time. But signs were emerging everywhere that they should. In September, the rising populist tide that was about to wash away the GOP presidential field first swept another major Republican figure out of his job. For the better part of 3 years, House Speaker John Boehner had struggled to contain a growing mutiny among his hard right flank. Twice before, its members had launched rebellions to topple Boehner and failed. But by the fall of 2015, driven by the same metastasizing energy fueling Trump's campaign, their influence had grown more substantial. For House Republicans, building an anti-establishment identity was becoming so important that membership in the Conservative Republican Study Committee, which denoted one's independence from party leadership, grew to encompass a majority of the caucus. This irked the most conservative members because it muddied the distinction they prized. So in early 2015, a few dozen broke off to form a new group, the House Freedom Caucus, that situated itself even further to the right. The group's chairman, Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio, said the Freedom Caucus would be a smaller, more cohesive, more agile, and more active conservative group, active meaning oppositional. Other Republicans resented the HFC's challenge. "They're not legislators, they're just assholes," complained one GOP aide, the craziest of the crazy. Yet the HFC's strident refusal to accept anything less than total victory, even under a Democratic president, set a standard that was amplified across the conservative universe by Breitbart News and talk radio. Over the summer, Mark Meadows, a North Carolina representative and founding member of the HFC, filed a motion that would trigger what amounted to a vote of no confidence in Boehner. It was a move that expressed the profound anger and frustration that had been building up in the party since at least the Tea Party wave of 2009. Republican leaders had repeatedly promised voters that if handed power, they would unwind the major Obama achievements, from the Affordable Care Act to the Dodd-Frank financial reforms. And although they had gone so far as to shut down the government in 2013 in a failed bid to defund Obamacare, Republicans had controlled the House for almost 5 years, and Obama's programs remained intact. Republican voters had cynically been promised fast, easy solutions. So when Boehner couldn't deliver, they were primed to chalk it up to betrayal. As the summer of Trump carried into the fall, and Republican fascination with the norm-smashing frontrunner kept growing, taking down a major party leader came to seem like a measure of the new populist strength. On September 5th, Breitbart took aim with a story titled, "Behind the Scenes with John Boehner's Worst Nightmare, Mark Meadows Launches Mission to Fix Broken Congress." At the same time, Trump was telling the country how easy it would be to strike deals if only voters would choose the right leaders. "We are led by very, very stupid people," Trump declared at a September 9th rally on Capitol Hill. But it didn't have to be that way. "We will have so much winning if I get elected," he vowed, "that you may get bored with the winning." Caught between the pincers of Breitbart and Trump, Boehner had nowhere to go. On September 23rd, a Fox News poll showed that 60% of Republicans felt betrayed by their own party's leaders. Small wonder. The next day, Boehner announced his retirement. The seismic news from Congress was enough to break through the wall-to-wall coverage of Trump and the presidential campaign. And the lesson it reinforced was the same one Trump was shouting from the campaign trail. If you don't like your party's leaders, you can get rid of them and install someone else.
9. Honest Populism. Trump's fixation with Fox News was a powerful force throughout the campaign, and the psychology of his relationship with Rupert Murdoch almost filial. He often told intimates of how Murdoch, whose approval he craved, had once humiliated him. As Trump was preparing to launch his campaign, recalled one person to whom Trump told the story, his daughter Ivanka arranged a lunch with Murdoch to share the news. "Rupert had never had any interest in me at all," Trump told this person. "He thinks real estate guys who made a bunch of money are a dime a dozen." Soon after the three of them were seated and the waiter brought their soup, Ivanka spoke up. "My father has something big to tell you." "What's that?" Murdoch said. "He's going to run for president." "He's not running for president," Murdoch replied, without looking up from his soup. "No, he is," she insisted. Murdoch changed the subject. Trump nursed the slight for months, seething at the indignity. "He didn't even look up from his soup," he'd complain. The insult weighed heavily on him, and it made Fox News a perennially fraught subject. Trump's willingness to flout any norm was a powerful source of his appeal, but sometimes it worked against him. Just before the Iowa caucuses, where Trump would at last subject himself to actual voters, he reared up and pulled a stunt that backfired. Soon after the August détente between Trump and Ailes, Trump's feud with Fox News flared up again, driven by the issue he was most passionate about, his poll numbers. Throughout the fall, Trump took to Twitter to lambaste his nemesis, Megyn Kelly, for the alleged sin of highlighting polls that disfavored him while ignoring those in which he fared well. "Isn't it terrible that at Megyn Kelly used a poll not used before, IBD, when I was down, but refuses to use it now when I am up," Trump tweeted in November. He kept after her, calling her "dopey at Megyn Kelly" and "highly overrated and crazy," and twice retweeting others who called her a bimbo. Whether Trump's animus toward Kelly was emotional or strategic wasn't clear. Either way, she loomed as a problem. Fox News was hosting a debate in Des Moines 4 days before the February 1st Iowa caucuses, and Kelly was set to reprise her role as moderator. Trump was determined to assert his primacy and force her off the stage. A week beforehand, he tweeted, "Based on @MeganKelly's conflict of interest and bias, she should not be allowed to be a moderator of the next debate." But Ailes knew a showdown would be ratings gold and stood firm. Trump, unwilling to submit, announced he would boycott the debate and hold a competing event to raise money for veterans. "Let's see how much money Fox is going to make on the debate without me, okay?" he said. Trump's confidence was aided by polls such as the Bloomberg Politics Des Moines Register Iowa poll, a legendary survey of support conducted by J. Ann Seltzer, a longtime Iowa pollster widely regarded as the state's finest. By tradition, the political world awaited Seltzer's final poll with bated breath, and when it arrived on January 30th, it showed that Trump had overtaken Ted Cruz to seize a commanding 5-point lead, 28% to 23%. Trump is leading with both the inner core of the caucus universe and the fringe. "That's what any candidate would want," Seltzer said. Yet on caucus night, amid a record turnout, Cruz won in a huge upset. Powered by Iowa's large community of evangelical Christians, Cruz won 28% of the vote, Trump 24%, and Marco Rubio 23%. Trump, who had predicted a tremendous victory, looked shattered. "I love you people," he told a crowd of supporters in West Des Moines that evening. "We will go on to get the Republican nomination, and we will go on to easily beat Hillary or Bernie or whoever the hell they throw out there." No one believed him. What's more, the outcome seemed to ratify every doubt political experts held about him. He hadn't bothered to raise money or do the hard work of traditional campaigning, had little campaign infrastructure, no polling, a weak ground game, a volatile temperament, and what appeared to be a fatal inability to translate media attention into hard votes. It had taken quite a while, but in the end, just as those experts had predicted, voters had listened to Republican leaders and come to their senses. Even Trump admitted error. "I think some people were disappointed that I didn't go into the debate." To all appearances, the voters had forsaken him. But they hadn't. 8 days later, on February 9th, Trump stormed to a blowout win in the New Hampshire primary, more than doubling the support of the second-place finisher, John Kasich. "Wow, wow, wow," a jubilant Trump declared afterward. "We are going to make America great again." By any measure, Trump's victory was a historic event. Had anyone proposed a year earlier that Donald J. Trump, tabloid fixture and star of The Apprentice, would overwhelmingly carry any GOP primary, they'd have been laughed out of the room. All along, many of those closest to Trump believed that his true test would come in the southern states that followed in the weeks after New Hampshire. During the fall, while other Republicans were blitzing states with early primaries such as Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, Trump was holding massive rallies in places like Alabama, which was bizarre according to conventional wisdom. Most reporters considered them an exercise in self-aggrandizement. In late August, Trump held a stadium event in Mobile, Alabama, which was so baffling to the local political cognoscenti that on the day he arrived, the front-page headline of the Mobile Press Register read, "Trump's stumping in Mobile, but why?" There were two reasons for the perplexing strategy. The first was the Trump team's belief that it could quickly lock down the nomination by winning the SEC primary, a nickname derived from the Southeastern Conference, the college athletics powerhouse whose member universities included many of the states holding primaries immediately after New Hampshire's. They included South Carolina, February 20th, Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Tennessee, Texas, March 1st, Kentucky, March 5th, and Mississippi, March 8th. Although there weren't many reliable public polls of these states during the fall, the few that were published showed Trump performing well. As a Trump advisor explained on the eve of the August stadium rally in Mobile, "With the lead he's got now in Texas, he feels that he can win the nomination on March 1st with a sweep of the populist, anti-establishment South." Trump was also relying on data beyond poll numbers. His brand and sales are strongest in the South, the advisor added. His TV ratings, his Trump resort guests. He thinks it'll pay off. The other reason Trump was focused on the Deep South was that he was trying to win the support of the man who introduced him in Mobile, and in fact resided there, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions. Well into the primary season, Trump lacked any endorsements from elected Republicans. No politician was as closely aligned with his positions as was Sessions, whose views on immigration and the GOP leadership, he was mainly against both, had made him an outcast in the Senate. Sessions could see that he and Trump appealed to the same type of voters. A lot of middle-class working people who don't trust establishment messaging. I call it honest populism, Sessions said in October. But he had withheld his formal support. Throughout the spring, Bannon was whipping the Breitbart staff like a jockey in the homestretch to champion Trump and scourge his opponents. Yet he rarely spoke directly with Trump, who didn't seem to need much help and was not even particularly aware of what Bannon was doing. Trump's singular media fixation was cable television. He didn't listen to talk radio or go online to read Breitbart. Instead, Bannon's major contribution during this period was brokering an alliance between Trump's world and Sessions. In January, Bannon prevailed on Lewandowski to hire Sessions' top aide, Stephen Miller, who had been smitten with Trump since his emergence as an immigration critic in 2014. Miller, too, shared Trump's broader discontent. Just before joining the campaign as Trump's senior speechwriter, Miller groused, "The Republican leadership is so out of touch with the conservative grassroots that I don't have an adjective strong enough to describe it." Luckily, Trump had plenty. The urgency Bannon felt about Sessions and the South was alien to most Republican strategists and thinkers. For the better part of 20 years,